Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week on the podcast, I'll be talking to Jeff Cole. Jeff is part of the investment committee for the Evans & Partners Global Disruption Fund, and he's the founder and director of the Center for the Digital Future. He's served as an advisor to governments and leading companies globally. He founded the World Internet Project 19 years ago, and he's presented his insights to the White House, the FCC, the Department of Defense, and global governments. He's testified before Congress, he's held a joint press conference with President Bill Clinton, he's even produced films with Vice President Al Gore, and today he'll top it all off by speaking to me on the rules of investing. In this week's episode, we'll discuss the current media landscape in Australia and how it's changing, the bleak future for employment globally, and what went wrong for MoviePass, which caused its parent company to fall more than 99.999%. Finally, if you're loving the rules of investing, then why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to iTunes and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Morning, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Patrick, great to be here.
I hope you've recovered from your, I hear your 83rd trip to Australia. I know it's a long way to come.
I feel like home, and it doesn't feel so far away.
That's good to hear. Good to hear. Well, look, we're going to discuss the media landscape both in Australia and overseas today, but I thought we'd start in Australia. It's a pretty interesting situation out there at the moment. There's a lot of things changing both at the industry level and at the regulatory level. I was wondering if we could start by talking about some of those regulatory changes that have come through recently and what they mean for the big local media players. So first of all, what were the major regulatory changes that we've recently seen?
Well, as you know, the media landscape's changing all over the world. Just this week, you know, we've seen a major change in Australia between Fairfax becoming part of Channel 9, and that's something we're seeing everywhere. In the U.S. this year, we've seen Fox, Rupert, all of a sudden, the world's probably most important media player, discovered that he had become a small player. And he didn't actually get small. Everyone else around him got big. He sold most of his major assets to Disney. Six studios have gone to five. Warner got bought by AT&T. We're seeing the same consolidation here in Australia. We're seeing that the free-to-air channels are troubled. And I'll talk for a moment about what I think is going to happen there. You're seeing the whole issue of pay TV change, the future of newspapers. So you're seeing massive change within Australia. And I mean, I think, for example, just to take 7, 9, and 10, and I think the same process is happening in America with ABC, CBS, and NBC. I've never predicted the end of free-to-air television, but I think for the first time in 60 years, we can see that the end is probably in sight. And what I mean by that, just to digress for a second, you know, in the studio space, Jeff Bezos and Amazon could have bought, he's much bigger than AT&T who bought Time Warner, he's much bigger than Disney who bought Fox. Bezos could have bought any studio he wanted. He could have bought Netflix and Disney, and there wouldn't even been a bulge as it was being digested. Instead, Amazon decided to build a studio. And within the space of a year, they've won Emmys, they've won Oscars, they've become a major force. Well, now I think Bezos and Amazon, not to mention Facebook, and Google and the Chinese, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. But I think Bezos is interested in sports. He's starting to buy small sports. He's starting to experiment. And he can't buy, in America, he can't buy the NFL or the NBA because the rights are tied up, just as the rights to the AFL and cricket and tennis are tied up here. But I think when those rights become available in 3 to 5 years, I think Amazon's going to bid on them. here in Australia, in the US, and as I've said to the American networks, but you could say this to 7, 9, or 10, if Amazon decides they want to bid on the AFL or cricket or any of the sport, rugby, any of the sports here, who's going to outbid the richest man in the world? Not you. And I think if 7, 9, and 10 lose sports, and you know how important sports are to them, that's why they're overpaying, probably at a loss leader point, but they need it. And if they lose sports, they essentially collapse, which doesn't mean that they go bankrupt and disappear. It means that their days as a 24/7 linear broadcaster come to an end, and they'll probably become an over-the-top service and on demand. But Australian free-to-air television, just like American free-to-air television, just doesn't work without sports. So there may be some regular, you have the anti-siphoning rules, but those don't really apply to over-the-top services. There may be some regulatory attempts to save some of the free-to-air television. But our work shows, the work we do at the center shows, and we've done this work in Australia as well, that for people under the age of 30, only 20% of their television is live. The other 80 is recorded or streamed. And of the 20% that's live, it's almost all sports. And that's why the prices of cricket and tennis have gone through the roof, because sports is still the only thing that aggregates a live audience at one time. There may be some regulatory efforts to break up the size of some of the companies. I don't think you're going to see that in Australia. There may be an attempt to try to keep certain industries from combining. But I think regulation, which was key to the Australian market, made sense when everybody was a healthy, vital competitor. Now, sadly, the whole industry has weakened. The whole television industry, Foxtel is going through some serious challenges, real competition from Netflix, competition from Amazon, who hasn't really ramped up their Prime Video yet, but will. I think Hulu will be here in another year or two. So I think the case for regulation has weakened considerably.
Yeah, certainly anecdotally, that seems to agree with my own experience. I see myself and many of the people I know around similar age, we watch very little, if any, television at all. Even the sports that we watch are often not what you would consider traditional sports, as a lot of people my age and younger are now watching esports instead of football and cricket, which obviously Amazon has taken note of, being an owner or the owner of Twitch, the biggest streaming platform.
They spent $1 billion on Twitch. Esports absolutely fascinate me. Now, I have I have an old guy's attitude towards esports. And in this context, old guy means somebody over 30. Because my old guy attitude was, that's not sports, watching people play video games. And I had one of my best friends sit me down and say, you're wrong. He was correct when he did this, because he said, what's a sport? A sport is something you play, and it's something you watch people play. And that's what esports are. So the demographics of esports are astonishing. Advertisers have taken note. You mentioned that Amazon bought Twitch. The really interesting question to me that we're trying to track is esports just a phenomenon of millennials and young people? In America, we see the audience for baseball is people over the age of 50, male and white. And the question is, will today's 20-year-olds in America become baseball fans, or will baseball just age out and die? So we see the audience in America and Australia for esports is young people under the age of 25. And the question I want to know, the numbers are amazing. If you look at the hits, some of these guys, some of these experts in esports who are like gods, get on YouTube. It's in the billions. So the question is, as today's 20-year-olds age, will they take esports with them? And when they're 50, will they be as big an esports fan? And will that mean esports then is 50-year-olds all the way down to teenagers? Or will they abandon esports as they turn 30? Will it always just be a young person's sport? I think they'll take it with them. But we don't have any evidence for that. But esports is changing the rules of everything. For somebody who's not aware, it doesn't seem possible. But stadiums are packed, just as they are for AFL games or rugby. Stadiums are packed with people watching people play video games. It's pretty amazing.
It's not just overseas either. I think there's a perception that this only happens in, you know, in Korea and in China and Japan. But in the US and even in Australia, we've had massive esports events here, exactly as you described, with stadiums packed out that would normally be used for traditional sporting events.
So yeah, it started in Korea.
I think you raise a really interesting question, and I don't know the answer to it yet. And obviously, there's no data on it, so I guess we just have to wait and see.
But my instincts say it's ingrained, and they will keep it with them as they age. But that's part of what's fun in my job, to look at these things.
I suspect you're right on that one. Well, let's talk a little bit about your World Internet Project. It's been going for a long time now. Was it 12 years? Is that right?
It's actually in January is going to be 19 years.
Oh, sorry. I got that wrong. First of all, for the benefit of our audience, could you tell us a little bit about what the World Internet Project is?
Sure. My background is television. I've worked in television production. I've worked with the American broadcast networks, and I've studied television. And in all the work I did in television, I was always taught that we blew it with television. We lost this great opportunity. Because television, if you think about it, is the only mass medium we knew ahead of time was going to be a mass medium. There was no question in the 40s and 50s that radio listeners were going to embrace radio with pictures. So what I was taught that we should have done but didn't do is we should have tracked people before they had television and then gone back to them year after year as they acquired and used it to see how it changed their lives. Where did the time for television come from? How did it change our buying behavior? And 1,000 other things. Cut to the 90s, I became convinced, along with a lot of other people, that digital, first the web, now mobile, was going to be far more important than television. So believing that we lost this great opportunity with television and that digital was going to be even more important, 19 years ago, we started tracking digital. We started in the US. We now do this work in 35 countries around the world. Therefore, we call it the World Internet Project. We've been in Australia since 2006. And we go back to the same people every year, and we watch how their lives have changed as they moved from non-user to dial-up, from dial-up to broadband. We watch as 2% globally leave the internet. And we want to know who's leaving and why, and more importantly, do they return, and if so, when and what brings them back. And then 19 years in, we track the non-users. Who are the 9% of Australians who are not online? Why are they not online? How do they do things the rest of us do online? And increasingly, they pay more to do those things offline. And then should we care about the never users in Australia? Should we be pushing them online, threatening them, subsidizing them, or should we leave them in peace? So we started, and now we sit on this incredible data that no one else has collected, 19 years. And I'm not really a researcher. I have competent research skills. I'm a storyteller. My job's to go out into the world with government leaders, including some of your prime ministers, there have been a lot of them recently, and our presidents, although not the current one, of course. And my job is to go out and talk about this to government leaders, CEOs, and just when we started, it's hard to believe, when we started, everybody connected to the internet with a PC on the desk and a hard wire to the wall. There was no mobile internet. There wasn't even Wi-Fi, let alone a little device in our pockets or purses with a camera that connects us to the world 24/7. So there was no social networks. The idea that one social network could reach almost half of the population on Earth wasn't even a dream. So we've really seen incredible change.
You refer to Wi-Fi there, which of course is an invention that came out of the CSIRO in Canberra, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe it did. And I do some work with David Thodey, who's chair of the CSIRO. I've always been impressed with the quality of the work that comes out of that.
Well, let's move on. I want to talk about a US company that's probably not familiar to many Australian investors. It runs a service called MoviePass. Now, I first heard about this company because it had fallen a long, long, long way in share price. It's hard really to get an understanding of the scale of just how far this company has fallen in share price. On a split-adjusted basis, it's down from about $8,000 per share to around 1 cent per share a week or so ago. Yeah. We talk about 10 baggers and 100 baggers as stocks that have gone up 10 or 100 times. And less commonly, you might hear someone say a reverse 10 bagger for a stock that's gone down by 90%. Well, Helios and Matheson Analytics, which owns MoviePass, would be a reverse 822,000 bagger. That seemed a big surprise to me when I looked at the business, because at first pass, it sounds like an amazing idea. The product sounds really interesting. So I know you've looked into this topic a little bit, and I was hoping you could explain it for our listeners, because it's a fascinating one.
I am fascinated with MoviePass. I've written about it repeatedly. It has been extraordinarily successful in influencing movie going. It's been successful in every way except for its investors, where it has been a legendary, colossal failure. So MoviePass, in America, like Australia, movies are expensive to see in the theaters. In New York City, which is our most expensive market, it's $16 to see a movie. The average in America is about 10. Now, I know those numbers are low for Australia, but in America, for a family of four to go to the movies and to buy food is well over $100. And movie attendance was down. Keep in mind that all of a sudden with Netflix, you could watch lots of movies and original production on your screen at home. The average Australian household has a television set 50 inches or bigger. And all of a sudden, dinner and a movie had become Netflix and Uber Eats. So, and movie theater attendance here and the US was declining. It's been declining for a long time. It takes a lot of effort, and the only movies that were doing well were the ones we knew we would like, whether it's Avengers, Star Wars. So MoviePass had this wonderful idea. Music has moved to subscription. All these media have moved to subscription. So they really changed their business model. They've been around for a while, but in August of 17, they offered a remarkable deal. $9.95 a month, you could buy a movie pass, and you could see one movie a day, which meant you could go in the longer months to 31 movies, and you'd be restricted to 28 in February. The only restriction was you could not see the same movie twice, and it didn't count for IMAX or 3D, the premiums. In New York at Christmas time, I went to 10 movies, which were $16.29. So I saw $162.90 worth of movies for $10, $9.95. The movie theaters hate MoviePass because they believed correctly it wasn't sustainable. People were going to get used to cheap movies, and then when they disappeared, they weren't going to come back. And therefore, there's no deal between, this is where why the stock price is down. There was no deal between MoviePass and the theaters. MoviePass paid the theater the full price of the ticket. So as I said, they were giving me $162 and getting only 10 in return. They argued, disingenuously in my belief, they argued they would make that money up on data. They would sell my movie-going data to people interested. I did a little bit of work for my column and asked all these data companies, here's me, here's what I did, how much is my data worth? They said maybe $5 a month. So MoviePass grew phenomenally. It was had less than 1 million subscribers last December. By March, it was up to 3 million. That was great news and horrible news. The great news is they had all these members. The horrible news is they were all going to the movies. And they were losing money like crazy. Their real game was to become so powerful they could demand a cut of the box office from the theaters and a cut of concessions. The theaters held firm. MoviePass just every month lost more and more money. But they were successful, in my view, because the theaters saw MoviePass was reawakening this love of going to the movies. It was causing people to go to movies, and movies they were willing to experiment on movies they wouldn't have spent that $100 for a family. We had three documentaries this year that became blockbusters. Three Identical Strangers, which played in Australia, Mr. Rogers, the Won't You Be My Neighbor, and I don't think our Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary. People were experimenting, so the theaters realized the future of movies is a subscription model. Our biggest chain, as who would never cooperate with MoviePass, but as they watched it die, AMC, owned by the Chinese, created their own MoviePass at $20, which lets you see three movies a week, which is a pretty good deal. If you went to 12 movies a month, that's a little over $1 a movie, and that is thriving. So I think MoviePass will be seen as the person who changed the whole way we go to the theater, but they're not going to be around to celebrate. Incidentally, another company that may be true of is Uber. Our work shows, Uber has succeeded beyond its wildest imagination. Uber is now a verb. That, you know, when all of a sudden, you know, Xerox became a verb, Google has become a verb, Ubering is a verb, but our work shows Uber subsidizes 60% of every ride. It's basically unsustainable. Not quite to the degree MoviePass, which burned only for about 8 months, but Uber, the only thing that can save Uber, in my opinion, is driverless cars, when they don't have to pay the drivers, but then Uber becomes a fundamentally different company where they have to acquire and maintain the cars. So MoviePass is now, in America, movies, like music, like Netflix, is becoming a subscription model. An all-you-can-eat, although I mentioned most of them are now not all-you-can-eat, but for most people, 12 movies a month is the same thing as all-you-can-eat. There were a handful of MoviePass people who did go 25 times in a month, but most of us have lives.
Did they not expect people to go that often? Because even if they were getting, you know, this incredible value from their data, it seems pretty short-sighted to think that at $16 a movie, you can charge people $10 a month and give them unlimited, almost unlimited access. Were they not expecting people to go as often as they did?
Well, first 16 was the most expensive market, just New York.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, but no, but it's New York is 16, but the most of the rest of the country is 10, 12. I think they were looking at the gym membership model, which is everybody after Christmas puts on a couple pounds or kilos, joins the gym. You go to the gym in January, you can't get in, and by February it's half empty. So but if you look at the average of $12 or so a month, for them to work, people had to go less than one time a month. And the problem is, let's assume people went less than one time a month. Within 3 months, they were going to say, what do I need the membership for? So they had to find the sweet spot between where they didn't go too much, but they went enough that they kept their membership. And that's probably around 1.7 or 8 times a month. And they lose money on 1.7. It just didn't work. I mentioned AMC went to $20 a month. It's become so popular that as of January 1st, 2019, they're raising their fees by $4. They're going to $24. At $24, if somebody goes 1.8 times a month, they're okay. So we're still looking for the sweet spot. $10 got the attention. It got 3 million subscribers, and it's why the stock price went down to almost nothing. So we don't know what the sweet spot is.
Well, I'm sure if they don't find it, somebody else will at some point in the future.
But it's really been interesting to watch.
Yes, it sure has. I would encourage our listeners to actually go and have a look at the share price chart. It's really something you'll never see anywhere else. The ticker code is HMNY. I think it'll be a long time before any of us see a chart quite like that again. But I wanted to talk a bit about a topic that is pretty close to my own heart personally. You alluded in something you wrote recently that you wanted to talk a bit about this in upcoming writings, but I'm going to jump the gun and get you on recording instead. That issue, of course, is privacy. It's been making headlines a lot recently with the Cambridge Analytica scandal and others, you know, mostly related to Facebook, but it's not just Facebook. In Australia, we had a company called PageUp, a HR company, that had their servers breached and people had their tax file numbers breached, which is an incredibly private piece of information. So it goes just beyond just what you're sharing publicly. It's what you're sharing that you think might not be public can become an issue for you as well. So perhaps I've maybe just answered my own question a little bit here, but why do you think internet users should care so much about privacy?
Well, first, they have cared greatly since we started doing our work in 2000. Privacy has run one of the worst, I don't know why I'm talking about my worst prediction, but the worst prediction I ever made was in 2000 when I said that e-commerce couldn't grow until people's concerns or fears about security and privacy went away. I was wrong. The value or the utility of buying online became so great that people bought in spite of those fears. And those fears have never gone away. In 2000, in America, 71% of people were very or extremely concerned about their privacy online. 18 years later, after massive amounts of internet use, that's only gone down to about 60%. That fear is still there. Scott McNeely, one of the founders of Sun Microsystems, had not my favorite quote, but probably the most accurate quote about privacy. He said, "There is no privacy. Get over it." We almost can't exist in the world today without without surrendering a little to a lot of our privacy. If you really believe in total privacy, cut up your credit card, but try renting a car or a hotel room without it. And the other thing that's changed is 18 years ago, people were saying, I'm concerned about my privacy, and they were saying to Amazon, or they were saying to AOL, or they were saying to these other big, can we trust you? You know, can I trust that you're going to do exactly what you say you're going to do? And what we found now is, by and large, we can trust these companies that they will do what they say they will do. Keep in mind, Google's motto was don't be evil. And I don't think they've ever been deliberately evil. But now it's not an issue. Facebook, I think, are well-meaning people. But it's turned out they aren't adequately able to protect us from hackers. And so even a company you thoroughly trust, you know, you may not be able to protect their own systems from getting all of your information. So what's happened with Facebook, in my opinion, is now an existential threat. I do a column every week, the one that appeared yesterday, which is part one of part two, is titled, Can Facebook Survive? Part two is going to be, Should Facebook Survive? I think they have totally abrogated any relationship with their users. Mark Zuckerberg's motto was move fast and break things. If you're not breaking things, you're not moving fast enough. I argue that at the end of all this fast movement, the thing that's now clear is what is broken is Facebook. And it's time for Facebook to move slowly and fix things. Because they clearly were sharing information with anyone who would pay. They had no policies, you know, really to protect their users. They would sell advertising to anyone who would buy it with no concern about anything except that the check clear. They have violated their trust to the consumer. So the question is, what do you do? Well, you know, when I was a kid, and it didn't matter whether you grew up here in Australia, in America, and anywhere in the world, mothers always told us all the same three or four things. Look both ways before crossing. Don't get into a car with a stranger. And a couple of other things. Now the job of a parent, there's about 10 new things, all internet related. Don't ever give out personal information online. Don't ever say anything online that you wouldn't want on the front page of the newspaper. And of course, they come back with what's a newspaper. Don't ever meet anybody in person who you met online unless it's in a public place. And, you know, so our kids have been really hammered in that everything they say, there's a permanent record. You know, I actually think one of the reasons Snapchat started with you send a picture and 10 seconds later it disappears. It doesn't literally disappear because there's always a record. But I think one of the reasons that became popular was kids that had hammered into them about privacy. So privacy is incredibly difficult to navigate, and you can't control it yourself. I mean, how can you live without some of these services we use? And everybody has airlines know exactly where we go. Our cars now with navigation systems know exactly where we go. All of that can be hacked into what we say on Facebook or email. And the only way to totally protect ourselves is not to be on any of those. And how do you live in a community without having digital relationships? It's not easy. So this is the most difficult issue of all. And then just to take it one more step, you know, there's advantages. I'll tell you what we're starting to see. I wrote a column about this because I'm fascinated. Chipping. The people who have chips planted in their finger. And I watched one of my friends get chipped in London. takes about 10 seconds. It's a chip the size of a grain of rice, and only about 1 out of 10 times is there even a tiny bit of blood. It's like a blood, like getting a blood test. Once in a while, there's a tiny, no pain. And but if we were all chipped, you can see the privacy implications. But there's also, if we were all chipped, there'd be no keys to our house or office. There'd be no ID badges. There'd be no locks on our doors. There'd be no passports, no credit cards. That part's pretty exciting. And of course, there'd be a total record of everything we do. But we're pretty close to that by carrying a cell phone. So this is a really complex issue.
I got to be honest, I'm not going to be one of the first ones signing up to get chipped myself. I think potentially if that becomes the way of the future, I might be one of those people that you have to wait for us to die out before we adopt the technology.
And we may see, you know, we may live in a world, it sounds like an episode of Black Mirror or Twilight Zone. We may live in a world where kids, babies are chipped at birth.
That's a scary thought for some people.
Incidentally, parents like the idea of chipping their kids in case they got lost, the same way a lot of pets are chipped. But yeah, it is pretty terrifying that somebody can watch everything we do, but we are pretty close to that.
Well, same as we're on depressing topics at the moment, let's stay on that note and talk about the future of employment. Now, obviously, since the Luddites, we've had people saying that machines or technology are coming for our jobs. So that was nearly 200 years. Well, actually, no, it was 200 years ago now. What do you think's different now to all the previous calls that machines or technology are going to take our jobs?
Things are a lot different now. And you mentioned depressing about privacy. I think with privacy, we get a lot of benefits as well. On the future of work, it's the only subject which I'm not an optimist about. I just don't see the solutions. Hopefully something is coming that I don't know. But historically, in America, in 1900, about 3 million people made their living from horses. Blacksmiths, carriage makers, people who clean up after horses. Today, about 40,000 people make their living from horses. But historically, the new industry, in this case, automobiles, creates more jobs than are lost in the old industry. That's not true anymore. We are now can clearly see a path where every driver job will disappear. If you're familiar with the Amazon Go supermarket, without checkers, we now can see every checker job slowly disappearing. We estimate in America 40 million jobs will be lost in the next 25 to 30 years. McKinsey says 850 million worldwide. Already 20% of legal work is being done by machines. We estimate 50% of surgeries in 30 years will be done by machines. That scares people, but I'd rather have a machine that didn't stay up too late the night before or have a fight with their spouse or too much to drink. And already today, artificial intelligence can read x-rays and MRIs better than humans can. They can see things that the eye can't see. So this is a real problem. We are going to lose massive amounts of jobs. We will create, for the 40 million we think we'll lose in America, I think we may create 3 to 5 million. So we are going to end up with a massive net loss. Some of my friends say this will be wonderful. There'll be a renaissance of poetry and great writing and freedom to be creative. And that's probably true. There'll probably be more creativity for 5% of us, and the rest will be watching television or playing video games. For the first time, you know, countries are discussing universal basic income, the idea of giving every citizen a sum of money every year. The Swiss considered giving $29,000 a year to each citizen. They ended up not doing it. But let's, politically, universal basic income is very, very difficult. But let's pretend for a minute that January 1st, 2023, we gave every American, every Australian $60,000 a year. That's not likely to happen, but pretend we did. That would solve a small part of the problem. That would mean everybody, nobody would starve, and everybody would have some form of housing. But that's about 10% of the problem. The other 90%, what's our purpose in life? What do? For some of us, work is just what we do so we can feed and take care of our families. But for most of us, work defines the limits of our lives. It's where we feel a sense of accomplishment. And without work, even if we're handed money, I think that leads in the first year or two, as I said, to too much television and video games. If it keeps on, it leads to alcoholism, depression, opiate addiction. Ultimately could lead to increases in suicide, and if left untreated for two generations would lead to civil unrest. So this, I really worry about this. So I did a conference last year in Tasmania with CEOs, and a woman raised her hand and said, here in Australia, we're different. We'll actually go to the market that has a person or the store that charges more money because we want to keep the jobs in our community. And I said to her, bless you, I wish that were true. But there's no evidence we've ever seen of people saying, I don't want to go to Costco or Walmart, and I'm not going to buy online. I'll pay more. It almost never happens. I tell a story, it's an anti-union joke. I'm not anti-union, but it's an important story. It's about a guy, it's a fiction, of course, about a guy building a skyscraper. And he goes to the construction site with the union foreman. And the union foreman sees a guy in a bulldozer clearing the land. And he says to the owner, don't you realize 10 men with shovels could be doing that work? And the owner looks at him and says, why not 100 men with spoons? And this is the choices we face. Will we pay more when machines can do it cheaper, and in some cases better, not in all, or will we always go to the most efficient? The record in history is we always go to the most efficient, which benefits us by cheaper prices. But if people lose their jobs, who buys all the stuff? This is a real problem, and I don't see the answer. And now, you know, I sometimes spend time on a college campus, and students are asking, as all parents are being asked, which jobs will be around in 30 years? You know, this isn't a big problem for me. My career is pretty well set. But if I were 20 years old, this is a real issue. You know, which job am I going to have for 40 years? And it's a very difficult issue.
Look, I want to just stay on that topic for one second longer. I don't know if there is a good answer to this, but if there is, it'd be nice to try and finish the subject on a slightly more positive note. But if you were in control of the economy and let's say the benevolent dictator, how would you fix it? How would you try to fix it? How would you approach it?
I don't know how you fix it long term. And in the past, this problem has always taken care of itself, what some of my friends say. But I'll tell you what I think might be a great model for the next 20 years. You know, the closest America came to this many people unemployed was the Great Depression in the early 30s. And Franklin Roosevelt, you know, who tried everything, threw everything against the wall and saw what stuck. One of the things that stuck was something called the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. He took these millions of unemployed people and built infrastructure around the country. That's when Hoover Dam was built. That's when the Tennessee Valley Electricity Authority was built, who were doing, clear in America, I think your infrastructure is newer, but you're going to hit this point as well. We built,
we've got a lot more population growth,
rebuilt infrastructure, put them to public work. And I think that's something that could both keep people well employed, doing meaningful work, and greatly benefit the country. That in America could be 20 years. Beyond that, it's hard to say.
Well, the governments here certainly seem motivated in the short term to do some infrastructure spending, so hopefully they stick with that. But look, that's the main part of the interview. I've got a few favourite questions that I like to do with every guest, so let's run through them now. They're supposed to be a little bit of fun, so hopefully we can learn something new. Could you share with us something that you've read recently? Could be a book, an article, a piece of research, anything along those lines that really impressed you?
Yeah, I do all this work in disruption. How companies get hit by disruption, how most of the time they sit back and don't change. And I read something recently that was pretty staggering to me, that the music industry, that at the beginning of the internet was staring death in the face, was standing on the edge of the cliff, and a heavy breath would have knocked them over. Well, it turns out, in the next 2 years, the music industry will be a bigger business than it was before the internet. So I'm now telling this story, which I call the rise and fall and rise of the music business, or to borrow from The Hobbit, there and back again. And it's a pretty compelling story how the music industry did stare death in the face. And now through Spotify and all kinds of different methods of music has survived.
Is there a particular article or book that you're referring to there that we could share with the listeners? Or is it just more as a general topic?
It's really what I've been, it's in work I've been doing, but there's no one article. But if you look at the rise of Spotify, you can see some of that.
Excellent. I'm sure we can find something to share with the audience. All right. So let's say for a second that you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university. And give yourself one piece of investing advice. What would it be?
I mentioned I'm really interested in disruption. I would look at the industries that are disrupting, that are really looking at a new way of doing old business. I graduated college in the late 70s. That would have been cable companies and satellite companies in the late 70s. It would have been computer manufacturers in the 80s. Today, it's the Netflix and the Googles and the Amazons. So I always look at companies who move into established businesses with new ways of doing things. And if you had invested in the disruptors, there were a few disruptors who disappeared. But far more vulnerable were the companies who did business the old way who disappeared, the Kodaks, the Xeroxes. So I would have invested in disruptive companies.
Kodak is always a fascinating story. I wish we had time to discuss it, but
I
always love
Kodak
hearing the story of Kodak
hours,
developing.
But the one thing I'll say, Kodak invented digital photography, and they knew the benefits, but they were making so much money in film they couldn't pivot.
Didn't quite work out for them, unfortunately, or unfortunately for their investors. But before we get into this last question, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting that you go out there and put all of your money in a single stock for 5 years and forget about it. It's supposed to be a little bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and a bit of fun. So with that being said, if the market was going to close for 5 years, starting tomorrow, and you could only own shares in one company, what would it be?
Well, I'm not a stock guy, so I'm not going to answer this based on stock price or price to earnings, which I'm not. I'll just talk about which I think is the company that's going to prosper. If you look at the big four, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Apple, we can see serious problems with Facebook. I can see innovation problems with Apple. The company I don't want to say invest, but the company I believe is going to make it long term and get bigger and bigger is the company that wants to take over the world, the company that wants to put everybody out of business, and that's Amazon. I can see headwinds for all of the others, most of which they'll get through. I don't see any headwinds for Amazon. They are so customer-centric. That doesn't mean that they're going to come to Australia and decimate your retail. They're going to take their share of it and do well, and hopefully will make the other retailers, the Woolies and the Wesfarmers, step up their game, and I think that is happening. But Amazon rarely makes mistakes. I think there's a piece of paper. I don't know if Jeff Bezos keeps it in the most secure bank vault in Seattle or it's in his shirt pocket, but it's a list of all the industries he plans to disrupt and in which order. Right now, it's banking and medical care, and I don't think it ends there. I think they execute brilliantly. You know, I was at Amazon in April and meeting with some of their senior guys, and they told me something that really was pretty staggering. They said every piece of consumer feedback in the entire company is read by Jeff Bezos. He doesn't answer it, he reads it. But what's important about, because his team answers it, but what's important is all of his executives know he reads it and he sees it and he frequently discusses it with them. It is, they are so focused on the customer, the value, they have so totally transformed so many industries. And now it's entertainment, and I said soon I think it'll be sports. So I would stick with Amazon.
Well, look, Jeff, thanks for coming on. I've appreciated hearing all of your thoughts and the insights on the industry. And I hope you have a good trip to Australia and a safe trip back home.
Thank you, Patrick. Couldn't have been more fun. And maybe I should just add that anyone who's interested in looking at our reports, my columns, it's all free. I would never try to sell anyone anything. They can take a look at any of that at our website, which is just digitalcenter.org. Center spelled the American way, or as I like to say, the right way. And it's all there.